At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Coming up on this week's show, the Sega Neptune is getting revived.
A one-button handheld gaming console.
And Darlene Lacey talks Disney and Dragon's Lair.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our incredible mates at Bitmap Books. Now, have you seen The Art of the Box? Celebrating the days when we walked into game shops and it was the cover art that really sold the game to us. Featuring biographies of some legendary artists, Bob Wakelin, Steve Hendricks, Ken Macklin, and lots more. And spanning over a massive 564 pages. If you love classic video games, check out that and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And use our code RH5 at checkout to save £5. And with our lovely friends at PCBWay. Now, I'm sure you know about PCBWay. If you're in the market for a fully featured custom PCB prototype, they've got you covered. Low cost, fast turnaround quality boards, and they do services like 3D printing and injection molding. And of course, PCBWay have always been massive supporters of the retro community. So get an instant quote right now on their website at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 435. Your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very, very warm welcome to the podcast that every single Friday takes you back in time to the classic age of video games. And of course, brings you up to speed on what's been happening over the last 7 days in the wonderful world of retro gaming and technology. And brings you a veteran of the industry onto the podcast in the second half to tell us their story. And we've got another amazing guest for you this week. Before we do that, I'm hoping that this show's going to go all right. We're not going to drip any sweat into our mixers or anything like that. I know.
That's a lovely image to start the podcast with, well, Dan.
We don't do video, luckily, because I think that's probably a good thing, being that we are probably in our pants and vests right now, because it is very warm here in the UK. A bit of a heat wave going on. But that does mean that actually it's going to be nice weather this weekend, fingers crossed, for the big event, because I imagine a lot of people now are in the hopefully nicely air-conditioned vehicles heading to Nottingham for Kickstart that is going to be on this weekend. So, you ready for it?
Yeah. Whilst this is coming out, I should be setting up the show.
So, yes.
You know, it's going to be really interesting. We've sold out Saturday tickets. And if you don't have one, it's going to be tough to get one. So, you know, we might have some last minute cancellations on the door.
Mm. But, you've got a Discord, haven't you, for tickets?
Yeah. And there's a ticket exchange on there as well. But also, like, after party tickets, you know, we're hitting about 200. So that's going to be a huge number of people there, and Sunday tickets are also available as well. So, yeah, check out After Party on Sunday. And also, Kickstart is fully air-conditioned as well. So.
Beautiful. Nice.
That's a bit of a bonus.
That's the thing. I mean, it is like 25 degrees here. And whenever I mention that on like Facebook, you know, people abroad are like, you know, another warmer country. Like you, Wims, that's a cold winter's day here. We're not used to it, though, are we?
We're not used to anything. A tiny bit of snow and the whole country falls apart.
But yeah, what weather are we used to?
Cloudy and rain, I think.
Rain.
It's been the last 8 months.
Miserable rain.
So, yeah, all roads lead to Nottingham for Ravi's massive Amiga event, Kickstart, that's going to be on this Saturday and Sunday. Last minute tickets. You can head to the website, amigashow.com. Join the Discord on there as well for the ticket exchange if you'd like to come along. Fingers crossed we'll see a few of you there. Now, I did mention that, of course, we have got another brilliant guest on the podcast this week. And we're going to be talking about Dragon's Lair. You guys remember playing Dragon's Lair back in the day?
I never played it back in the day, but when I went to Florida in 2017, we found an arcade that had a cabinet in there.
Right.
And I was like, oh, I've got this. This is going to be well easy. And no, it wasn't well easy. I didn't make it very far at all, but really enjoyed playing it. And then I played it again at Arcade Club in Leeds.
Yes.
You know, obviously that had unlimited plays because that's where you pay to get in, and then everything's unlimited. And I got a little bit further before I gave up with it. You know, notoriously difficult game, but graphically, absolutely stunning for its time.
Yeah, it was absolutely groundbreaking title. And this week we have Darlene Lacey on, and she was a game designer, creative writer, and narrative designer for AMS, who were Advanced Microcomputer Systems, and they did Dragon's Lair, but also Space Ace. Do you remember Space Ace?
I've got that on the Philips CDI.
Ah, yes, because it was another interactive title. But also, she did one called Dog Eat Dog, and I don't know if you've heard about that. That was a quite mature FMV, and it was all about the office environment and commercial world, and you had to kind of try to, you know, put people off and take down your enemy, and it was a huge, huge production. They had 20 actors in there, and they'd filmed 200 minutes of film before it got cancelled, which I'm sure there's going to be
some good, I've never heard of that.
good stories about that title. And then she went on to become a game producer at the Walt Disney Company as well. So, of course, I'm sure you know about DuckTales on the NES, Joe.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, classic. Iconic.
Yeah, she was a producer for that. Chip and Dale Rescue Rangers as well, Mickey's Runaway Zoo as well. So there's loads of titles that we're going to talk about, you know, spanning from the kind of early Laserdisc films into Disney games.
That makes sense that you went to work for Disney as well, because I always thought with like Dragon's Lair and Space Ace, they look like they could be Disney movies.
Totally. They've got the same feel and the kind of same idea of a narrative and a storyline as well going on.
Yeah, so going to be a really interesting one, getting the story of those early AMS Laserdisc games, Dragon's Lair, Space Ace, and lots more as well with our special guest, Darlene Lacey, who will be on the show in around half an hour from now. But you know the way the podcast works. First half an hour is when us nerds have a bit of a geek out about what's been happening in the world of retro from over the last week, and some more big news stories to sink our teeth into this week. And this one actually kind of nicely follows on from something we were talking about last week when we mentioned that there was a modder who basically tried to make his own Sega Neptune. Well, it turns out if you ever wanted a Sega Neptune on your desk, there has been some pretty big news from a Brazilian company. Now, for people that might not be familiar with the Neptune joke, give us a bit of background on it.
Oh, man, I always get completely confused with the different Sega planets and what they all are. So the Sega Neptune was a cancelled console, Sega console, which was going to be a Mega Drive with the 32X built in, which is what I was getting mixed up with the Sega Pluto last week. So the Neptune is the one, which is a Mega Drive with a built-in 32X. And Sega did show off the prototype of it. And it looks, I always thought it looked a little bit like the Mega Drive 2, but with a little bit more of a, like a, I want to say sleeker, more angular look to it. A little bit like the 32X. So essentially, if you got a Sega Mega Drive version 2 and mixed it with a 32X, this is what you would get. I always kind of felt like that. But famously, because the 32X flopped, they cancelled this. They only ever made the prototype. And then they moved on to the Sega Saturn. And the rest is history. But yeah, interestingly, there is still a big Sega community in Brazil, which I'm sure a lot of people already know about with Tectoy, etc. But this is a completely different company, and I don't want to butcher their name, but they're making an FPGA-based Neptune clone console.
I think they're called GamesCare.
GamesCare, right, okay. Yeah. And interestingly, it is completely based on, you know, the prototype model of the Neptune. In a nice silver case rather than a black one, so a little bit different. And it is going to include the Mega Drive slot, and it is going to be able to play 32X cartridges as well, which is really interesting. But it will also have an SD slot on there and also be compatible with Sega CD, which is really interesting.
Well, this is an FPGA-based console as well. So, I mean, when I first heard about this, I thought, is it just going to be like a Raspberry Pi in there that does emulation or whatever? But no, this is like, you know, FPGA, obviously, you know, hardware simulation, I think is generally the best way to describe it, because if you mention the E word, everyone goes ape. You know, when you're talking about FPGAs, it's not. It's actually hardware that's simulating other hardware.
Yeah.
So it's generally a lot more compatible than using a software emulator, for example. Should be pretty much the same as the original. But yeah, it is interesting. So I think, obviously, there's always been a desire for cancelled systems, particularly stuff that's become collectible over time. You know, everyone would love to have a Sega Neptune on their desk. Although there are a few things that I think are bizarre design decisions from this. Now, you did mention there you got the SD card slot, which I think is great. You know, basically you can download all the games, play them on that. Makes complete sense in 2024 to have that, but also be able to play the original cartridges. I think that's really good. It's got Wi-Fi and an online store as well, apparently, so you can purchase games online, which is very good. You can apparently link it up to a proper Mega CD as well, so it will work with the Mega CD. The weird things for me are the fact that, firstly, it is silver, not black. I wonder why they've gone with that decision, because surely if you've always kind of craved one of these, you'd want it to kind of look as similar to the original prototype as possible.
Yeah, you would have thought.
Yeah, and to me, like, you know, those classic Sega consoles, I mean, I know there are different colours in different parts of the world, like, you know,
maybe
in Japan.
Maybe there's rights surrounding it. Maybe they can't do that.
It could possibly be the case, but but I mean, it looks very similar in otherwise, doesn't it? Yeah, that could be the reason why. But it's just for me, you know, when I think of, like, that era of Sega, the Mega Drive, the Saturn, you know, that kind of sleek black look.
The CD.
Yeah, on CD as well, yeah. I mean, they all look like that in that period, the early to mid-90s, before the Dreamcast came along, you know, from Sega. So I think it is a bit of a shame that it doesn't look like the prototypes did. And also the video output as well, apparently it's going to just have HDMI 1080p.
Well, that's step up for Brazil, because if you looked at the Sega consoles they were producing for years, it was still component. And, you know, even when HDMI was introduced, because they were saying a lot of people we're still using those televisions, so 1080p HDMI is pretty good.
But personally, I'd want, you know, that is, I think having that option there completely makes sense today, and I imagine a lot of people would use that, but I think there will also be a large selection of potential customers, me included, that would love some, like, RGB kind of output or SCART, you know, to be able to connect it to a CRT, which, you know, is obviously how those games were designed to be played on. You know, they're meant to look like that back in the day. So I think I always prefer, and I'm definitely not alone in this, playing my consoles on CRT displays, you know, my retro system. So yeah, I think that is a bit of a shame that it doesn't have that kind of analog output as well, from what
well,
I can
see. Well,
it
could have, you know, it's an FPGA, so updatable firmware and CRT filters and all of that kind of stuff could come to it. I've never heard of this company GamesCare though before.
No, I mean, obviously we did. I mean, we actually did a whole episode with Tectoy, didn't we, who famously kind of make, you know, Sega clones and
yeah, I think they've kind of stopped doing that now.
Right.
But they were doing that for a long time because they had the publishing rights in Brazil, and they could kind of produce companies because Brazil was like a separate economy, basically. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I'm not sure we'll ever get a release of this outside of Brazil. So me kind of complaining that it doesn't have the traditional Sega multiport out is probably completely irrelevant because I've got no chance of ever getting my hands on one of these anyway. But I mean, they might pop up on eBay for, I'm sure, a very inflated price. But I think it's a cool idea though. And obviously they think there is enough of a market there to sell them. I mean, I've got a 32X, never got around to getting it working properly. I've got like some bad flicker on it. I've tried stripping it down and stuff as well. But to be fair, there's not really a huge library of 32X games that interest me now.
Yeah.
Is there anything you've ever played with, Jokes? And obviously, you're a big Mega Drive fan. Have you ever been interested in the 32X?
I want one just because of, you know, Sega, Mega Drive, etc. Yeah. But obviously, they're very expensive now. My friend had one when we were teenagers. You know, he got it dead cheap. He bought it from Game Station and it came in a shoebox. And I think he bought it for £20 with a bunch of games. And famously, there's some terrible games on it, but then there's also a couple of really good games like Calibri and Knuckles Chaotix. It's meant to be really good as well.
Right.
And I have played them on like emulation and stuff, but I'm not in a rush to go spend like £400 on a 32X setup. But yeah, this is the GF1 Neptune. I don't know if we mentioned it, but I'm interested to see if any like YouTubers like Stop Skeletons from Fighting managed to get their hands on this and, you know, kind of tear it apart and see if they, like, you know, play the entire kind of 32X library on it and see if it's all compatible, etc. You know, if there's any issues. And, you know, there is on, like they say, it's going to be compatible with the Sega CD. And I can see from the pictures here, you know, that they've mocked up, it does have the little, it's the exact same kind of like slot that you take off the side of the Mega Drive and the
expansion port. Yeah.
Yeah, the expansion port. So it's all there, you know, ready to go. I'm just interested to see how it would, you know, actually plugging in original Sega C hardware. I know it simulates the hardware, but just the compatibility of it. Like, I'm not clued up with this stuff, but that just sounds like it'd be really difficult to get it working. But if that's what they're doing, I trust that it'll work.
Well, it looks like they've done a console before, which is the Neo Geo Consolized MVS.
Okay.
GamesCare version that they're selling on their site. So, you know, it looks like they've got a little history of it.
Yeah, I think with FPGA, I think, you know, I'm a lot more confident that this will be more compatible than software emulation. And it's good to see it's got the original connectors for the controllers on the front as well. You know, it's not like USB or anything like that. It just plugs into the original Mega Drive controllers. It's got the D9 connectors on there. So, yeah, interesting device. And I think, you know, for me, like I said, I'm not all that interested in the 32X library, but I think the appeal for me would be finally having a long-lost cancelled prototype in my collection, albeit like a clone of it, but I think that will be the appeal. So, yeah, for me, if it had that, you know, the analog output and they made it black, I think that would be much more interesting for me, but very cool to see it. And like you said, Joe, look forward to seeing some videos of this hopefully at some point soon. So if you want to read more about that, I'll link that up in this week's show notes. Now, I'm always a bit of a sucker for a new Nintendo Switch game, particularly this time of year when, you know, we're all traveling around and everything. The Switch is great to bring on the road with us. And we did mention, you know, there are so many fighting game collections coming out recently. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest ones ever, the Marvel vs. Capcom Arcade Classics Collection. 7 of them are coming to the Nintendo Switch.
This is a big one for me, boys. So I am a massive Marvel vs. Capcom fan. And I was actually moaning when we covered that Arcade 1-Up had done a cabinet for Marvel vs. Capcom and, you know, how expensive it was and stuff like that. And then recently I've been obsessed with the X-Men animated cartoon, which is obviously Marvel. And I went down this huge rabbit hole of like kind of going through all the X-Men versus Street Fighter, you know, Marvel vs. Capcom games and kind of the legacy of it and where it all kind of started and where it got to a point where I've already got a few of them in my collection, but started wanting to buy some of these classic games, you know, on the Dreamcast and the PlayStation and Sega Saturn and stuff, and realizing they're not very cheap games, you know, some of them in the £100 region. To then remember that I actually had Marvel vs. Capcom 2, which was like the ultimate one, for Xbox 360. And this was about a month ago. So I was like, oh, you know what? I'm going to go download that from my games library. And it said that it had been removed from the store and I could not download it, which really annoyed me. But I was like, well, that's weird. Like, you know, like X-Men's huge at the moment and that's part of this legacy and everything. It all makes sense now. So they have announced this week, yeah, as you say, the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection Arcade Classics, which should be coming out in Q4 of 2024. And it doesn't give us every single game because of it doesn't give us the more modern 3D ones, but it gives us all the 2D Marvel vs. Capcom games, starting with X-Men Children of the Atom, Marvel Super Heroes, X-Men vs. Street Fighter, Marvel Super Heroes vs. Street Fighter, and then Marvel vs. Capcom, and then Marvel vs. Capcom 2. And then there is a bonus game in there, The Punisher, which was the first ever Marvel and Capcom game that was ever produced, which is actually a beat 'em up game for the arcade, but they've put it in there to say this was like where the kind of like the unity, the relationship of Marvel versus Capcom started.
Right. I hadn't heard of that one. Yeah, I was looking the rest on the list I'm familiar with, but that one I was like, what the hell is a Punisher?
Yeah, the Punisher is actually a, you know, in the vein of Streets of Rage, you know,
right,
Final Fight, etc., and was the first ever game that Capcom and Marvel worked on together. And then Children of the Atom, which came out in 1994, was the first fighting game they made using the Street Fighter engine, but with X-Men characters. And then that's where the Versus kind of started. Well, that legacy of games started. So I'm really, really excited for this. But there's been a bit of an outcry online. So this is coming to the Switch, Steam, and PlayStation.
Right,
but
no
there's
Xbox.
Been no announcement for Xbox. And it's not like one of these where they just announced the game and they've not put what consoles it's coming to or anything. It specifically says like PlayStation, Steam, and Switch.
that happens quite regularly, though, doesn't it, that the Xbox kind of gets left off?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is weird. I'm not really sure why.
It's really weird. It's really strange. And there's been a few things about it. There's been quite a few, like, theories and stuff behind it. They've announced a physical version of this for the PlayStation as well. So it's not even... It obviously will be a downloadable game, but it is coming out, you know, physical version of it and stuff, which I'm really excited about. And obviously, I have an Xbox. I don't have a PlayStation 5. I've got a Switch, so I'll probably have to pick up on the Switch. But the rumors are saying, and this is quite interesting, is that the actual game engine that these games play in isn't compatible with the Xbox Series X.
All right.
And Capcom, and apparently Capcom have just decided it's not worth the time or effort or money to get it running on Xbox, you know, to integrate it into playing on Xbox because of there isn't as big a user base for Xbox, which, you know, I know there isn't, but there's still tens of millions of people on Xbox.
There's still a few of them out there.
There's still a fair few out there. Like, you know, I know it's getting outsold by PlayStation and definitely by Switch, but there's still, like, I don't know what it was last time I checked, 20, 30 million Xbox One, Xbox Series X users, and obviously 60 million Xbox One users. I'm not saying they're obviously all being used anymore, but it just seems interesting that it's not coming out on Xbox, but also really, really cool that this collection is coming.
To be fair, if you were thinking of buying one of those arcade cabinets, I think, you know, you could probably buy a PlayStation 5 for cheaper than one of those. Anyway. Well, if you really want to play this. Yeah.
I think it's quite a nice progression. So, like, I don't know the X-Men games that well. I've played a few in the arcade and stuff. And if I wanted to see change in graphics, play style and development, this pack would be really good. And it's got, well, it's saying original arcade soundtrack songs will be released on there as well. I never seen before artwork from, like, development, which I think is really good, as you can see the whole progression of it and take it in one kind of bite and have all of that there, explore it all and just get wrapped up in that world.
Yeah, and you hit the nail. I get completely wrapped up in it all. I love Street Fighter, I love Marvel and X-Men and Spider-Man and stuff like that, so these games just, like, absolutely fascinate me, and the kind of, like, the story.
I used to read the comics of X-Men, but I didn't get that into the games, and this could be a good way of doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. But really, really excited for this. Like I say, no word on actual release date. They're just saying late 2024. You know, I might actually be able to finish these as well because they're notoriously difficult. And obviously, you'll have save states and stuff on modern consoles with these. But who knows? Maybe the Xbox version will get announced after the outcry, you know. I've been sat there reading it all. I'm not going to lie. There was a few days there where I was Googling it for updates from IGN because IGN had said they'd reached out to Capcom and they'd reached out to Xbox and both had refused to comment on the situation.
Right.
So I was a bit like, oh, that's interesting. Like, maybe it is coming. I don't know. But here's
I'm just more impressed I've actually managed to get all the licensing worked out to release this because that must have been a nightmare.
Well, yeah, because I started Googling when I was like, oh, where's my Marvel vs. Capcom 2 gone off, like, you know, my games library. I was Googling that and there was, you know, people saying, you know, on Reddit and stuff, like, oh yeah, it's gone, it's been taken down. It must be because of its hell on earth for licensing because of there's like 50 plus characters in some of these games, you know, and obviously the licenses to Spider-Man and everybody, Iron Man, all of them, you know, they're all in it and everything. And it must be a nightmare, but here we go, they've done it.
Yeah. Awesome, and yeah, hopefully going to be in your Christmas stocking this year, Joe. It looks like it's going to be coming out quarter four, a bit of time before Christmas to play that. So the Marvel vs. Capcom collection, if you want to keep an eye on that and check out the trailer that is out there right now, and I'll put that in the show notes as well. Now, I love this. This is something we don't see very often. A game that came out back in the day that is getting a remaster from one of the original developers. And this is big news because this is actually for the system that it was first released on. So we're talking about the Amiga version of Dune 2 is now getting an updated AGA version from a guy called Bob Kuhn, who worked on the original Dune 2 back in the 90s. He's decided that he can make it better.
Yeah, he can make it better because the PC version had like full music and stuff. There was a lot of extra stuff. And obviously Dune 2 was like the granddaddy, that one of the best RTS games. You know, and loads of people played it on the Amiga. It was one of the great Amiga titles.
But, did you sink a lot of time into that back in the day?
I did in Dune. I was a bit more of a SimCity guy, but I did spend a lot of time in Dune. But there was, it was still a bit clunky. You know, stuff got introduced like the minimap and like, you know, the concepts as well. So kind of Command and Conquer was when it really hit me. But that was also from Westwood, you know, and this is the same team that developed Dune. It all kind of came together as well. And this guy is actually one of the original Westwood developers as well.
Yeah.
And really cool to see him actually taking a step back and redoing the Amiga version. Because I remember when games like Theme Park came out for the PC and they had like, you know, video intros and they were always a bit more, usually because of the chip RAM limitation with the Amiga and what people had, you know, kind of the certain amount of megabytes that were available.
And a lot of Amiga games had to be playable off floppy, didn't they? Because all PC users had hard disk, but a lot of Amiga users didn't.
Yeah, or CD-ROMs as well later on. And yeah, I think this is really nice. It's going to get cleaned up, going for AGA as well, which hopefully you could do some impressive tricks with now. I'm wondering if he'd do an accelerated Amiga version.
Yeah.
And, you know, if that's going to run a lot smoother. And I think it's kind of nice that he is going back to the original one. But I do worry a bit about rights, but I'm sure this guy's a smart guy, you know, putting it online and being able to do it and redo it, especially having worked for Westwood. I'm sure he's aware of all of that kind of stuff.
You think he knows the right people, fingers crossed.
Yeah, definitely.
But yeah, I mean, it says, you know, originally that the Amiga game, it had a lot of disc swapping, which, you know, when it got to that era of the Amiga, when games kind of, you know, when it was on two discs, it was all right. When they kind of got to 3, 4, 5 and beyond, if you didn't have an external drive, it could be a bit of a nightmare. And he said, you know, the animations from the DOS version would chop down the soundtracks as well.
Some of the speech was taken out as well.
Yeah. So he's basically saying now he wants to make Dune 2 for the Amiga the way it was meant to be and put right everything that went wrong with it. And yeah, like you said, going to be an AJ-specific version of it, fingers crossed as well. So if you want to support that, he's not selling the game, but he said if you join him on Patreon, you can pledge your support there. So his Patreon members will be able to get to play it. So if you want to check that out. I think it's really interesting to see, and obviously very well timed with, like, you know, Dune being huge again these days.
Yeah,
I think it's perfectly timed. And also, you know, the fact that he's doing it for the Amiga. So when I first read that headline, I thought, oh, you know, they must be doing it for the PC or something. But the fact that you're going to be able to play this on your Amiga 1200, an improved version of the game you played as a kid, I think that's awesome, especially coming from one of the original devs. So if you want to check that out, I'll put that in the show notes as well. A bit of Dune loving. Now, we do like to cover these weird little handheld consoles. These seem to be coming out quite regularly. This one could be possibly the smallest one we've ever seen, and maybe the most limited as well. But I must admit, I do quite like the look of this. This is a one button handheld console.
I just... why?
Yep. If you have to ask why, Joe, then...
then you didn't have a Tamagotchi.
Yeah, well, it's smaller than a Tamagotchi. It's tiny. It's about the size of... I think it maybe even... What, about
a packet of Tic Tacs, maybe?
No, it's smaller than that. I'd say about the same size as a Switch cartridge.
Yeah, or like an SD card or something.
An SD card.
Yeah.
It is... absolutely tiny. It's great for Dan. There's only one button on it, so he can play it.
Oh, then again, they actually demo Flappy Bird playing on this, which is a solid game. It's a really difficult game to play.
You have to think of those kind of one-button titles, don't you? Like, Flappy Bird's a great one.
Yeah, that's what you
can't think
for,
of any other ones.
So this is by a YouTuber called The Wrench, who puts this together in a really, really interesting video. It's a DIY fidget device, he describes it as. Or a teeny tiny gaming console with only one button. And it's quite in depth, but it's not too kind of like, you know, geek talk. You know, I understood what he was doing, etc., which was nice.
Geo-friendly.
But yeah, it's so small. It's got a 0.38-inch screen by 0.27 inches. But most interestingly, it is actually an OLED screen.
Yeah.
So it's in super high definition still. And like you
monochrome,
say,
though, isn't it? Black and white screen.
Black and white monochrome. I don't think he had room for colour. but interestingly, like you say, he did choose Flappy Bird as the game of choice for a one-button game that he was thinking of to play on there. And it's definitely more of a novelty than anything else. But yeah, I would say it's probably about the same size as a Tamagotchi screen.
Yeah.
To kind of put it into perspective.
It would be easy to sneak into prison, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, that's true.
I won't ask where, Ravi. But yeah, I mean, again, it is one of these things that you said, Joe, why? But I think it's just because you can. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's awesome that you can basically make a games console these days out of such tiny components.
And, I can imagine this could be like a nightmare for a classroom.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you work in a school, Ravi. You can imagine the kids all getting all these.
Kind of playing with those, yeah.
I mean, it is quite cool that you could, you know, they do mention in this article on Retro Dodo a few ideas that you could put it on, you know, your keychain, for example, or you could wear it on a necklace if you're a bit of gaming on the go.
Yeah.
Maybe an earring. It could work like that.
Maybe if just someone's really always fidgety and distracted, got some ADHD, you know, sit them down with this and it might calm them down a bit. That could have little benefits, you know?
Yeah. I think the fact that he called it...
Get bored after a while unless you can flash new games and then maybe get into programming yourself.
Well, I think the fact that he calls it a fidget device, I mean, it is kind of that, isn't it? Just something to keep your hands busy, I suppose.
Yeah.
So, and it looks like, you know, all the parts are very affordable as well. So if we get all the files for it as well, he's actually made them all available to his YouTube channel members. So if we get hold of those, I'll link that up in the show notes as well. Check out that video. It looks really cool. Now, there's one story before we hop into our interview with this week's special guest, Darlene Lacey, on the way in just a minute. We're talking about strategy games, and I know you're big fans of games like Roller Coaster Tycoon, and you love SimCity back in the day, Ravi, as well. Well, this is a new game that looks right up your street. This is a game called Car Park Capital.
If I didn't hate car parks so much, I'd probably enjoy this. The graphics look absolutely fantastic. It looks like Transport Tycoon mixed with SimCity 2000.
Yeah.
It's got really lovely, lovely graphics. Actually, like many Tycoon games at the time, the whole idea is, you know, you're fixing the terrain and you're building car parks within it as well. When you're kind of managing the car parks, but also taking over the area. And, you know, we've got a lot of NCP car parks in the UK, and they all sprung up after World War II when there's a lot of bombed land. And
just to fill the gaps.
To fill the gaps and turn them into car parks.
We must rebuild car parks.
Exactly. But now you're trying to convince towns in this game to fully convert their town into a car park. Like, there's weird propaganda like, you love car parks and stuff like that that you put up in their town.
I really love the look of this as well, Ravi. Like you say, it's straight out of like a Tycoon game from the mid-90s. Graphically, they've captured it so well to a point where when I was reading up on the news before we started recording, I actually told my missus, because she loves Roller Coaster Tycoon, I was like, babe, come and look at this game, which I've never done before. And yeah, I've got a feeling we might end up downloading this and having a little play on it.
Well, this looks like a super early demo.
Yeah.
It was just a trailer, really, in a 46-second trailer. There is a Steam page that is online right now. It looks like it comes from a developer called Hilkoji Interactive. No release date as yet, no pricing as yet. There's, you know, if you watch the trailer, there's not even any sound on the trailer so far. So it looks like it is just kind of very early work in progress. But I think, yeah, I mean, it does remind me. Again, it was never really a genre that I was into back in the day, these simulator games. I think theme park was about the only one that I really played. But it does remind me in terms of the looks of those.
Yeah,
kind of
I think it's, you know, being a modern title, it's going to have much better AI with the drivers being able to park easier and the pedestrians in the right spots and stuff. You know, some of these games are quite broken. People would gather in corners, and, you know, kind of the paths that they take wouldn't be amazingly good, but I can imagine it can be done pretty well today.
Yeah, I think even the user interface as well reminds me of those games. It's kind of, you know, looks very 90s.
Traffic in these games are huge. I used to watch a YouTube channel where a guy would, all he'd do is fix the traffic in City Skylines, and he'd go around and like someone would be like, fix my city, and he'd spend 5 hours changing the traffic lights and the one-way systems, and that was it. And it was so entertaining, and it get the whole city flowing again, which, that satisfies a lot of people.
I think that's probably one of the things that puts me off playing these games, because I just imagine I would sink so much time into these if I got into it.
You get a job in a traffic light controller.
Yeah, I know how to do it all. Yeah. So it's called Car Park Capital, in work in progress right now. But you can check out the trailer. I'll put that. And of course, everything else we talk about, you don't have to Google around. I save you the job each week. Check the podcast app, the notes section on your podcast app, or head to our website at theretrohour.com. You can click through from there. Okay, then talking to Darlene Lacey about those classic Laserdisc games, Dragon's Lair, Space Ace, and lots more. She's coming up on the show in just a moment. Before we do that, let's take a second to give a massive thank you to this week's sponsor. It is our lovely friends at Shopify. Now we know Shopify. You've heard us talking about them before. Now, if you sell anything at all, it feels like everyone's doing it at the moment. Everyone's doing a little side hustle. Maybe even think of becoming your own boss right now. Shopify is the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. And it is revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. If you come along to Kickstart this weekend, I'm sure you'll see a lot of these little Shopify point of sale systems. Because, you know, as we said before, when you come to retro events these days, very rare that people bring cash. I don't know about you guys. I've actually been to quite a few events recently where the vendors don't even take cash.
I've been to quite a few countries where there's no cash. Yeah,
so if you're going to any retro gaming shows over summer, you'll no doubt see these. Maybe actually sell stuff yourself. You know, I've got friends that sell books on Shopify. Mate of mine sells T-shirts on there as well. Really, if you sell anything, you know, it could be anything from fine art prints to home and garden, health and beauty stuff as well. Craft fairs, I've seen these there. They cover all of your sales channels, whether you're selling in person or online. Shopify has got everything you need to grow your business, and even taking care of all your social media marketplaces, Facebook, Instagram, TikTok as well, full of industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth and giving you complete control over your business and your brand. Best thing is as well, it's so easy to use. You don't have to learn new skills, no design, no coding, nothing like that needed. And they've got support to help you every step of the way. So if you want to try out Shopify for yourself, no matter how big you want to grow, they'll be there to empower you with the confidence you need to take your business to the next level. So it is time to get serious about selling. And why don't you give Shopify a try today? Now, of course, we've got you an amazing offer, like we do with all our sponsors. You can try out a trial period of Shopify, see if it's for you. I'm sure it will be, for just £1 a month. A no-brainer to give it a try. So head to our link so they know that we sent you. Help out the podcast as well. Shopify.co.uk/retrohour. That is all lowercase. I'll put it in the show notes as well. Shopify.co.uk/retrohour. And get ready to take your business to the next level today and hear a lot more of this. All right, then. Well, thank you for checking out the news this week. We'll have more for you on next Friday's podcast. Hopefully we're not too worn out after after Kickstart, and we're able to talk on Tuesday or Wednesday when we record the show.
Yeah, let's see. Yeah. How many drinks I have.
A little reminder as well, our patrons are going to be moving our hangout because of Kickstart this weekend. We're going to be doing that next Sunday, so the first Sunday of July. I believe that is July the 7th, looking at my calendar. So all the details for that will be posted on our Patreon. If you'd like to join us for that, all the details to sign up and support the podcast on Patreon are on the website at theretrohour.com. Right then, special guest on the way, Darlene Lacey, going inside the world of Dragon's Lair, Space Ace, and lots more as well. And of course, those classic Disney games. She's coming up on the show next.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and we're here today with Darlene Lacey, and she was a game designer, creative writer, and narrative designer at AMS, which was Advanced Microcomputer Systems. You know, they're famous for Dragon's Lair, Space Ace, what an absolutely amazing title that was. and she also worked for the Walt Disney Company. So there's some amazing stories there, and stories about Dog Eat Dog as well, which is a really interesting cancelled FMV game that we're going to talk about. First of all, how are you doing, darling?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me on the show. It's such a pleasure.
Oh, it's great to have you here. And, you know, we have this question that we ask every single guest when they come on. What was your first video gaming experience?
Well, I know you have a lot of old timers here, right? Because it is the retro hour. But so this will date me, but it would be back in 1976 with the Coleco Telstar system. You know, the original one with the two little knobs and playing Pong. And a friend of mine, her father bought it, brought it home, I think, for Christmas. And we were like, wow, look at this thing. We'd heard about it, but had never had any experience with it. And it took a little while for him to get it hooked up, but we were all just astounded by it. It was so cool. And I have to say, these minimal games, I don't know if, you know, computer gaming ever really needed to get any better because they were so much fun.
Really captured your imagination, I bet, playing that for the first time.
Yeah, it did.
Yeah. Well, speaking of which, actually capturing your imagination, did you do a lot of story writing when you were growing up?
Yeah, I did. I've always written. I'm still writing. I do a lot of things, but I think primarily people think of me as a writer. And when I was young, I was really fascinated by, I don't know how familiar you would be with them, but the TV movies of the week that would tell these lurid stories of, you know, people with, you know, demonic possession and other kinds of things like that. And that really caught my imagination. And so when I was young, I would write these lurid stories, you know, about teenage girls that are getting caught up in murder mysteries and things like that. And so I was always writing stories and always hoped to be a writer. But as I was getting older, you know, it seemed like, you know, the main pathway, at least in terms of education, was to become an English teacher, which I did not want to do. I never wanted to be a teacher. So I wound up going into broadcasting as a college degree to sort of hedge my bets career-wise. But I was really thrilled that I did get to pursue my interest as a writer as an adult. And I do want to add to that, too, since we're talking about games, I was also really interested and fascinated with games when I was young. I think the very first game I remember playing was Concentration with cards, which, of course, is something that translates well to the computer. And yeah. Also the Game of Life, that board game really had a huge influence on me, I think, as a game designer, because it had this whole kind of, you know, simulation, really, of life. And it had its three-dimensional board with the spinner and the way that you would add your family to the cars and all of that was very interactive. And in fact, I designed a game, a board game, when I think I was in grade school that was based on the Game of Life, and somehow talked my parents into mailing it to Milton Bradley.
Oh, wow.
But apparently they weren't interested in it. But that was my start with designing games.
And I saw years later, you were involved with the PlayStation version of Game of Life as well.
That's so right.
Yeah, it kind of came full circle. I was wondering, were you ever into any of those choose your own adventure ones or any kind of text adventure computer games?
Not really. I think the first time I saw one was when I started to work at AMS. And I remember it was Zork, I believe. I remember playing some of that, just these text-based adventure games, which wound up being something that I became a huge fan of. But when I first started to play, I was very frustrated by sort of the tricky nature of the game. I felt that there was a little bit of just, you had to figure it out. Just some of the puzzles and obstacles felt a little perverse to me, which I am not against as a game designer, but it sort of inspired me to create games that were a little bit more like life is a game and how do you solve puzzles in real life and sort of drawing upon that as inspiration.
Well, you were kind of hanging with a group of creatives as well and in an area of technology. And I was wondering what their kind of approach was like compared to a lot of coders that, you know, designed and made games back then.
Yeah, it was really a different world when I was starting off in game design, because, you know, we used to all joke that none of us grew up, you know, expecting to be game designers, because it wasn't really a thing. You know, very few people were designing computer games. And we all fell into it because of some creative interest or another, I think primarily writing. And so, you know, when we'd come up with games and just, you know, create ideas, they're often very story-based or inspired by cinema or by music, things like that. It wasn't so much that games inspired us to design games, you know, because even though they were an influence, they were still really just in the beginning stages. And we had a lot of other strong influences creatively growing up. So I think it created a really great creative dynamic in the offices that I worked in when I was young, where we would just bring in ideas from all kinds of directions. And it was very stimulating. And I think it's one of the reasons why you didn't see some of the game designers, great designers that I knew in the early days, really stick with it in the industry. And in fact, I sort of dropped in and out of it doing different things as well, because it became more about, hey, let's take this existing game and let's do something better with it. Like, let's improve the video, or let's make it faster, or just things like that. Let's just improve an existing game. Whereas I think most of us wanted to create completely unique and new games. And so there was a lot of that creative energy at the time.
So how did you end up at Advanced Microcomputer Systems then? And what did you know about the company before you joined? How did you hear about them?
Well, I really knew nothing about them. Well, maybe a little bit, I could say. So what happened was I really kind of stumbled into it. I was probably at that time, I was either 21 or just turned 22. So I was young and I was still just in the middle of getting through college. And I was really one of these young people that didn't have any great career plan. You know, I wanted to be creative. I wanted to do something that, you know, inspired me. But, you know, you looked at careers and it all seemed like a lot of drudgery. And so because of that, my strategy was to basically not have any job. I just sort of, you know, worked my way through, you know, spent most of my time working at school and doing a few odd jobs here and there. I worked in a plastics factory for a while, some things like that, but I didn't have a really serious job and I didn't know what to do. And so my group of friends at school, we were all brought together through a poetry class, and we all loved to write. And one of my fellow poets got this job. He saw a posting at the nearby, at the job board at the nearby college, Cal Poly Pomona, where, as it turned out, a lot of people from AMS, they came from Cal Poly Pomona, and they hired him to be a creative writer, writing interactive fiction for this home system that they were developing. And they were looking for more writers. And so he suggested that I go there with my friend Donna as well and interview. And I don't know what they thought at the time, because we just came in. We were very bohemian, very just kind of irreverent. But And, you know, maybe they liked the fact that we were willing to work for $40 a week for all we could write. I don't know. But anyway, they hired us. And so when we initially started working, we were writing for this experimental console that they were building called the Fantasy Machine, which later became Halcyon, if people are familiar with that. But that was much later. And so they had at the time was this little, you know, machine that was running on cash register tape with little felt pen kind of illustrations on it. And they had punches on the side so that it could seek out the frames on this cash register tape. And the idea was to create interactive choose your own adventures, but with with images and start to head towards the idea of multimedia. But it was still very limited and early in its development. And so when we were writing our scripts, they were very brief. You know, a whole game could be something very brief. And it was still very minimal. And in fact, when we first started, we weren't even developing them on computers. We were writing our scripts with notepads and pencils, which is the way writers such as myself like to work a lot of times in the early days. And so my first assignment was something that I didn't want to do at all. I was into punk rock and film noir and things like that. I was hoping to do maybe a hard-boiled detective story or something kind of cool and modern. But I was given the assignment to write a Jack and the Beanstalk adventure game. And I was so disappointed that I wound up writing it, bringing in things like, you know, biker motorcycle gangs of bugs and other strange things that you would find on the leaves and the clouds as you're climbing up the beanstalk. And it's probably needless to say they never developed that one, but I still have the script for it. And it was a lot of fun. And as we were working on these games, the technology was improving. They were starting to look into doing it with these more like video cassettes and, you know, bringing more of the multimedia into it as we went along. And so after a while working there, I really caught the bug for game design and kind of stuck with it for the rest of my life.
Do you remember the first time that you saw like a Laserdisc and, you know, the visuals from there?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was at AMS because we were struggling with how to crack the nut of bringing multimedia in some sort of practical way to adventure gaming. And I believe it was Marty Folger at AMS who walked in with a Laserdisc and said, I was thinking that this might be a solution to our problems. And I don't remember what he had, but I do remember early on also seeing that game Astron Belt. We went to an arcade to look at that and getting some ideas from that. And as soon as we decided that we were going to move forward with Laserdisc, then we started to bring in anything that we could get to look at it. And I had the Pioneer players there. I later bought one of my own, but they were very impressive. I still love the Laserdisc technology.
I love seeing them as well in stores when they basically look like a cross between compact discs and vinyl records, didn't they? They were really, the artwork looked amazing on them because it was so big.
Yeah, they were really cool. I mean, it's sort of a lost technology, right? Mm. But I think one of the things that was so neat about them, which goes back to, you know, vinyl records, was the size.
Yeah.
Because even though, as we know, as technology progresses, everything gets smaller, but there's something to be said for holding that substantive thing in your hands and being able to have a really nice design on the jacket and just have something that you really can bond to.
Yeah, like a work of art. Yeah, 100%. Yes. Well, let's get into the game that most people probably know AMS for, of course, the legendary Dragon's Lair. And I heard that game took around 6 months to make. So what do you remember about, you know, starting to work on that game and how it initially got started and how it changed during those 6 months from start to end?
Well, it was really kind of a do or die project because AMS, they were having trouble really continuing with the development of the fantasy machine. The price point was just too high for it to make it a viable commercial, you know, home platform at that point. And so we were looking for other ways to kind of salvage the spirit of what we were doing. And I wasn't that involved on the, you know, executive level with it, but somehow or another, Rick Dyer and Don Bluth got together with the idea that we could potentially create an arcade game version of what we had been doing, and that if that succeeded, that could generate the revenue to help fund further development of the fantasy machine. And so it was a very tight deadline. It was a very tight budget for something as ambitious as it was. And so we all had to scramble very quickly and sort of shift gears from what we were doing. And the idea was to take a little bit of really the leading title that we had for the fantasy machine was called The Lost Woods, which later became Thayer's Quest with the Halcyon unit. And but it was this sort of, you know, medieval fantasy. And so we thought that that was probably our strongest suit for a type of title that might catch the interest of people at the arcade. And so we had to figure out really quickly how we were going to design this game. But we had some background in it because we were already working on creating interactive stories using these film strips. And so, you know, we were faced with this really sort of daunting and unique challenge of whatever it is you're going to design, you have to commit to it because it's going to be animated. It's going to be, you know, printed to film. It's going to be printed on the laser disc, burned to the laser disc. So it had better work. And so when we looked at the challenge with this, especially with an arcade game, because, you know, normally with an arcade game, you have so many options, right? You can go anywhere. You can do anything. But with this, we had to break the world down into these little video segments, and we had to connect them up, and we couldn't have infinite or a huge number of branching options. And so we had to create something very tightly designed. So we set to work with these tight designs, with these vignettes that we all know from Dragon's Lair, and the art department storyboarded them, and we figured out to say, okay, let's say like it's Dirk and the burning ropes, the swinging ropes. He's going to start here. The ropes are going to swing like this. And when the ropes reach a certain angle and, you know, distance from Dirk, this is the time where he can jump and he can successfully swing on the rope. And if he doesn't hit this window of frames, then he's going to fall or what have you, or just not catch the ropes. And so we meticulously storyboarded all these scenes and scenarios, and then we took them to Don Bluth Studios. Oh, and then also I should add, because you're asking about how things changed.
Yeah.
Originally, we thought that our hero, he was going to be a guy named Rolf, and Rolf was going to be sort of your typical ass-kicking action hero kind of guy. And so we took all these ideas and these storyboards to Don Bluth Studios, and he looked them over. And he came back with Dirk the Daring, which surprised us because, you know, Dirk looked a little bit like a doofus, right?
Yeah.
And we were surprised by that, really. But in hindsight, obviously, Dirk the Daring was a good idea. And so, and then he, I think, I'm not sure where Princess Daphne came into it, but we were also surprised by her because she was much sexier than anything that we had been envisioning. So he was really in charge of the characters and sort of taking it and turning it into this cartoon movie kind of experience. And he set forth with making all these beautiful locations and scenes and everything. But what really surprised us, and keep in mind, too, we were on this breakneck development cycle, was that he looked at our very static, tight storyboards and said, well, this is very boring from a, you know, cinematography kind of point of view. And so he made all these cuts, camera angle cuts, and he also changed our backgrounds to include doorways and passages that we had nothing scripted for. And we didn't have any time to develop all kinds of new scenes and cutaways for the design where Dirk could go through that doorway, you know. And so we found ourselves with something much more beautiful than we were picturing, but also with a lot of gaps in it in terms of what you could do interactively. And we were out of time, we were out of money. And so the solution that was arrived at is that Don would animate a lot of blockers. And that's where we started to get lots of, you know, goo and tentacles and other things that came in to block your passageway. And so none of that was part of the game design. And yeah, I should probably add too, because you'll probably wonder about it, the flipped scenes. That was also because we looked at it and we said, oh, shoot, we don't have enough footage here to really make a long game. And so the solution was to flip the scenes. And unfortunately, in some cases, with everything being mirrored, like ye old whirlpools, the text got flipped and reversed. But there was nothing we could do about it. It was what it was. But if anybody's wondering why the design was a little kind of strange, that was a lot that had to do with it.
Well, I was wondering what the relationship was like then, because it was Rick Dyer Industries and Don Bluth Studios. And like, how important was their background, and what was it like working with the two studios and the two guys?
Well, it was really stimulating, you know, because we came in as the game design experts, even though, of course, you know, we had no experience making a Laserdisc game. And Don Bluth came in as the animation and character and story expert, even though we were writers. And so, and then of course we had Cinematronics down in San Diego as the, you know, the cabinet makers and the technology, and all three really had to work together. But it was really cool because suddenly we had, you know, a professional animation studio working with us. And that's the sort of thing that, you know, today with, you know, gaming studios, they probably wouldn't think much of it. But for us, it was like, wow, we've hit the big time with this. And it was really cool to go into the Don Bluth Studios and see the rotoscoping that they were using and other techniques like that. That was totally new to us. And I think those were probably some of the earliest or first times that those techniques were used for computer games. And of course, we were able to do something visually that was really unparalleled. And so it was exciting to see all that come together.
It was a great, great kind of transition. And I was wondering how the studio kept costs low at the time as well.
You know, I'm not sure about the animation. I know we had a very tight budget when it came to the animation. And I know they worked around the clock with it. I think limiting the scenes and flipping the scenes was a major part of it. And really, AMS, we were a very kind of, you know, low cost kind of studio. Like, I think people would have a hard time if they work in the industry today to imagine what it was like back then. Even when I was at Disney, we just had these skeleton crews. We had a couple of artists. We had, you know, a handful of writers, game designers. We had a handful of programmers. And then, you know, just a smattering of staff here and there. And most of us were college students. And so I think, you know, Rick Dyer was able to keep costs down from that perspective as well, because we were all just working our way through college, but he had a lot of really talented people there. So it all worked out with that kind of, you know, budget, but I think you'd have a hard time doing that today.
What about the sound recording as well? Because I know there was a lot of, you know, voice samples in there and stuff.
Yeah, I think all the sound, you know, it's a little hard for me to remember that. I think it was done by Don Bluth. At AMS, we had this attic that was always being repurposed for one purpose or another. And Rick put in a sound studio up there that we were using for the Lost Woods and our other projects. And so that was something new as we were starting to, you know, delve into multimedia. But it was kind of funny because it was in the attic, and so it had this very low ceiling. And so some of our, you know, staff were very tall people, and we would all have to crouch and get into it. It felt like, you know, some sort of old woman in the shoe kind of, you know, studio. So that was, you know, my personal experience with sound recording at the time.
Well, I remember seeing Dragon's Lair in the arcade back in the 80s. And when I saw that game for the first time, it looked like something from the future, you know, because every other game around was like 8-bit or maybe even 16-bit sprite-based games. Seeing Dragon's Lair, I wasn't aware that video games could look like that. So do you remember seeing the kids' reaction to the arcade when it first entered the arcades?
I do. I mean, it was incredible. And I won't lie to you. Like, when we were playtesting the game, we were going to make it a 50-cent, a pop game. And it was so hard to play, right? And if you didn't know the design, you could die so quickly in this game. And I just thought, I don't know if this is going to fly. It looks great. But from a gameplay point of view, it was, really asking a lot. At sometimes you just had to keep playing the game until you figured out what the game wanted from you. So I had my doubts and we put it out there. And as you know, it just took over the world. It was phenomenal. And I remember going to the mall and seeing just the spillover of people outside of the arcade, I believe it was Kingdom of Oz, and all these people were gathered around, not only in the arcade, it was standing room only, but outside looking through the window, watching some, players working their way through it. They had it up on a pedestal so people could watch. And that's the first time I've ever seen anything like that. And I actually have a binder that I kept of all the news clippings that were flowing in on our telefax, with all the, stories of, these arcades and the crowds that they would draw. It was astounding and really exciting to be part of it. They had a playoff on it on the TV network show, That's Incredible. If people haven't seen that, you can probably find that on YouTube. I mean, it was like Dragon's Lair was a celebrity. It was incredible.
I do remember going on the game, though, and literally dying, on that first bit when you go over the drawbridge, probably about like 20 times, and then running out of money. But I remember I just wanted to see what was next. I mean, do you remember the kids kind of having to learn? Because, I mean, it was definitely a game of reaction, wasn't it? Did that kind of stump people a bit at first, like it did me?
Yeah, no, I mean, people were very frustrated with it. I do think those who made it, from start to finish, they sort of became celebrities in themselves, in their own right. But, you better have a lot of quarters. Mm. And that was something that, I mean, if I didn't have unlimited lives so I could do all the play testing, I mean, I would have never played that game. But also, I created a design to show how you could jump around from frame to frame if anyone wanted to program it to win the game. So I knew the game like the back of my hand, but only because not only was I part of the design team, but because I could play it infinitely.
You could probably go into the arcade and impress a lot of kids doing that. Yeah. I was wondering, was there anything cut from the game that you wish had been kept in?
There were a few little small scenes I remember that became like the hidden scenes or the Easter eggs. It's hard for me to really remember now. There are just some little snippets. But no, I think pretty much everything we designed more or less wound up in there because, again, time was of the essence and we didn't have time to design a lot of surplus. It was a very let's get it done kind of design process.
And did you enjoy going into that kind of sci-fi theme away from fantasy with Space Ace?
Yeah, I think in general, that's something that I'm more drawn to. I was never that much into, fantasy, really, the knights and the swords and stuff. It's okay, but it's not really like my primary interest. And so Space Ace was fun to design. At that time, I think, a lot of people were kind of coming and going at AMS because there was a lot of opportunity. We had designed the first games. And if I recall correctly, I believe that it was me and Shannon Donnelly who wound up designing Thayer's Quest as well. It was the two of us that mostly co-designed Space Ace. But when we gave our storyboards over to Dom Bluth, I think he threw out almost entirely everything that we had done other than some core ideas. And he changed the game design to suit his purposes. So really, in the end, there's not much of anything that I worked on that is visible in SpaceAce.
So when did you leave AMS and how did you make the move to the Walt Disney Company? Because that must have been an interesting move.
Yeah, you know, so I left AMS. I joined in 1981. I left in 1983 because AMS was growing. And so they were going to move the office, our little strip mall office in Pomona, to Carlsbad down by the coast, which would have required moving for me, which I really didn't want to do. And around that time, I was graduating from college. And so it just seemed like the right time to go. And it turned out to be a really good move for me, because what I did next was I worked for Sega of America, Gulf and Western, Paramount Studios. They were looking to make Laserdisc games, arcade games. And so I became part of a little Tiger team that went to work at Paramount Studios. We were working on a game, a Star Trek Laserdisc coin-op game, which was really exciting and cool. We did not get to finish it because that's at the time where the bottom fell out of the Laserdisc arcade game market. So that was really disappointing, but I was able to do a lot more design-wise and really being tapped in with the studio than we had access to at the time at AMS. And after that, I worked on some CDI game designs and other things like that. I was really, you know, kind of in the genre of early multimedia. But the opportunities there were also kind of hit or miss and often required moving, let's say moving up to the Bay Area. And I didn't want to do that. I'm kind of a Los Angeles girl. So for a while, I didn't do anything at all, except I was working on my own text adventure games on my own, just freelance. I wanted to do this game called the Case of the Leading Lady, which was like a big text adventure mystery on a ship, cruise ship kind of thing. Mm. But I wasn't doing much. And so anyway, when I was at Sega Gulf and Western, I worked with Sam Palahniuk, who had made the coin-op Sega game for Sega, what was it, Gremlin as well back in the day. He was kind of a famous game designer. And we had lost touch, but he called me up and said he was working at Disney. They were looking to start making computer games, and they wanted to bring in some really innovative thinkers with that to be the first line of producers. And so it wound up being me, Sam Palahniuk, and David Mullick. We were the three that basically launched Disney's entry into the computer game market.
What was it like working with David as well? Because he's absolutely legendary in the video games world.
Oh, it was so much fun. I mean, we just had the best time. You know, again, we had this sort of, you know, cream of the crop there. And I felt pretty honored to be included with it because, you know, I was doing multimedia and we were looking to do, you know, more of your basic, you know, C64, Apple II, IBM PC kind of games, which I really didn't have any experience with, you know. And so I had to really kind of rethink how I approached game design with it, which was also stimulating for me. But those two, they also gave me some inspiration and experience with that as well. And so David, you know, he was just a pleasure to work with and had a lot of great ideas, as did Sam as well. And I think I brought a lot of interesting ideas to the table as well. So it was a very creative dynamic.
Was it strange for you moving from, you know, kind of full video to computer graphics and the change that happened, and how did you kind of adapt to that?
Yeah, you know, it was a challenge because not only was I used to having the luxury of multimedia and had to really strip down my designs, they put me in charge of the value line on top of everything, which was just 1 5-1/4 floppy disk to create some sort of compelling computer game experience, which was a challenge. But on top of that, it was Disney, the Walt Disney Company. So it has to look as great as possible. You know, people have, you know, expectations. And so when I was designing these games, I was always pushing, can't we make this a little nicer? Can't we do something a little bit more? But also drawing on that early experience with Pong, right? To say a fun game is a fun game. And so looking to kind of bring that concept to whatever it was that I was making, and how can we pack as much content into the, you know, the small format as possible. So it was really a new challenge in terms of game design, but also as a producer, I had to really be the advocate and say, can't we just find some creative way to make this a little better?
I was going to ask about that, because I've seen, like, you know, Disney have got like style guides and Bibles that you have to stick to about how, you know, even characters' eyes can look and how they move and everything like that. I mean, was there much of an approval process? Because obviously these are very well-known characters that you're working with now at Disney.
Yeah, it was tough, especially in the first years, you know, because, you know, let's say you have something like the Amiga or, you know, the Commodore 64, you have some options with the graphics a little bit more than you would, let's say, especially with the PC in terms of animation or the Apple II. It was just terrible across the board. And so you have something like Mickey Mouse. And the whole thing with Mickey is to have him look on model is dependent on having these very subtle curves to his shape of the head, the placement of the ears, the curves of the eyes. And, you know, Mickey can just melt like in an instant if you have too few pixels for him. And I remember sitting there myself, just clicking away in Deluxe Paint, trying to make Mickey look a little better. You know, it's like, here, let me take a go at it. Because often you had programmers in charge of the graphics, and programmers often didn't have the fine look at it. They're like, oh, well, this is good enough. It's like, well, I don't think it is, because it's never going to get approved by Disney's creative services. And we would have these packets that we could work with line art for the characters and all the style guides. But again, no blame on anybody, because you reduce it down to a few chunky pixels, or just even with the colors, you know, it's very hard to make the characters look good. But I will say this, I think we did accomplish a lot using those limited palettes and pixels. It just took a lot of trial and effort to make them look as good as they did.
So Donald's Alphabet Chase was converted to systems with, you know, lesser graphic options and stuff like the ZX Spectrum. And, you know, you had the Amstrad versions as well, and also the Commodore 64. How was it kind of porting all of these, and did you have any involvement with that process?
Yeah, I had to look at all of them and approve the specs. I think the way we went about it was we came up with the gold standard design and said, this is the best it's going to look. And then we would look at the ports and say, okay, what compromises do we have to make for this one? And sometimes we would change the design a little bit to work around limitations. You know, we did a lot of handcrafting from port to port to make sure things looked as good as they did. I don't know if Disney's creative services looked at each and every port. I think they understood that sometimes it is what it is. But I did. And I would go through, I actually did a lot of handwork myself, even though as a producer, I didn't have to do that because I was just trying to make things as good as they could be. For example, on another one of those preschool games, Goofy's Railway Chase, I didn't get that right. Goofy's Colors and Shapes, I think it was called. I can't remember now. In any event, I wrote the theme song and digitized it and did some things like that to brighten it up as much as I could. So I was very hands-on with every port.
It's interesting you mentioned then about the educational aspect of it as well. I mean, did Disney see that as being important, that games were educating their audience?
Yeah, they did. We had a couple of, you know, as we would call swim lanes today, but we didn't back then, for Disney software. We had the educational component of it, and we were particularly working on the early learners in preschool, which was an interesting design challenge in itself. And then we were looking at the core Disney branded kind of games, you know, Dick Tracy and things like that, Roger Rabbit, DuckTales, you know, obviously with the Nintendo games people are familiar with, using the licensed properties. But then we also developed our Buena Vista software label. And I was kind of the driving force with that because I wanted to create new IP for Disney. My feeling was, why not? We're creatives. We're generating new content. Why must we be limited to the Disney characters? And so I started designing a whole series of adult adventure games and advocated for the idea that it could be the Buena Vista label, much like Disney was doing with their movies. And as fate would have it, none of my games actually made it onto the Buena Vista label, I don't believe, but that became another track that we were on at Disney Software.
Well, before we get into that, we'll get into DuckTales, which was an absolutely stunning game and had a lot of attention to detail as well. What was it like working on this title?
DuckTales was really an easy title to work on. It was really a pleasure. I've talked about it a lot online, but just for anyone who doesn't know, David Mullock was the original producer on it. And he did a lot of the footwork getting it started. And I think somewhere around midstream, he was moving over to do some other titles that needed more of his attention. And so I was asked to finish it. And so by the time I received it, a lot of really great things were already in place. You know, the game mechanic, the worlds, a lot of the music, some of it still changed, but it was well underway. And so I came in to really kind of give it the spit and polish at the end. You know, probably my most notable changes involved the dialogue, which needed a lot of work. You know, when you talk about characters being on model, it's not just how they look or how they move, but it's also how they speak. So I pretty much rewrote the dialogue and adjusted it to make it fit well within the tiny little text window constraints that we had on the NES system at the time. And then also gave more guidance in terms of certain things that were like a little off model, you know, things that, you know, Scrooge McDuck, you know, wouldn't necessarily collect, or things, you know, just like the props and the sprites that they were using, making them more on brand. Probably really my biggest contribution is the infamous ending to DuckTales, which ended with Scrooge McDuck, you know, making a proclamation about the most important thing in life, you know, talking to Huey, Dewey, and Louie, is dream and friends. And that has that sort of a cult following in itself.
do you still get a lot of interaction from DuckTales fans as well?
I do. People love that game. And you know, people talk about Dream and Friends. There's like a website, dreamandfriends.com. And, you know, I loved it so much because it was so heartfelt, but I felt like it really wasn't capturing the spirit or the language of Scrooge McDuck. So it pained me, but I rewrote it and created the new ending to it, which I think was the right decision, but it was a hard decision to make.
Well, obviously, that game was published by Capcom. So what was the relationship with Disney and Capcom like?
Oh, it was really positive. It was a great relationship. And, you know, keep in mind at the time, we didn't really have email or any easy way to communicate with each other. So there was a lot of DHL, FedEx going on with the carts going back and forth. And so, you know, and a lot of correspondence. And so I would write up notes and send them off. Usually, I believe, fax it to them. And then they would send a new EEPROM to put in the cart. And then I could play test it. I mean, really, it was kind of me and them, you know, back in the day. We didn't have a lot of testers, game testers. And so I would get the cart. I would play it through. Thank goodness, again, for unlimited lives. Type up a bunch of notes, send it off to them. And they seemed really appreciative of the thought that I was putting into it and the concise level of changes. You know, some producers, they start to dream a lot and make a lot of big changes. I was always looking at it from the point of view, hey, they have already put a lot of great ideas into it. How can I support them by making a few little changes to make it even better? And let's get this done on time and make it as great as it can be. And so I think they appreciated my role with that. And we use that same system for Chip and Dale's Rescue Rangers, Mickey's Dangerous Chase, and Adventures in the Magic Kingdom.
Well, I remember you saying, you know, Buena Vista Software as well was kind of a way of Disney focusing on like more adult titles. And one of those was Dog Eat Dog, which was a really interesting game because I heard, you know, you had like 20 actors and it went into 200 hours of development. So what are your memories of that and what kind of happened?
So Dog Eat Dog, you know, it's kind of my white whale. You know, I really thought that this was going to be the game that would, you know, let me plant my, you know, flag to say I'm one of the, you know, great game designers from the 90s, but it never happened. And it's interesting that it still is out there, though. There's a lot of interest in it because it was such a progressive game, and maybe someday we will finish it. I do own the rights to it. But so just, you know, a quick synopsis. So I had this idea, and this was before Dilbert or Office Space or anything like that. Like, wouldn't it be great to make a big adventure game based on navigating a dysfunctional office? And so it would be a comedy. It would be a huge, robust text adventure game with very simple graphics. I had this idea to kind of do this pop art, comic book style art that would be kind of, you know, supporting the theme that the office world is kind of this paper thin cartoon kind of farce to begin with. And I hired a development team that became close friends of mine that didn't even come from the game industry. And we agreed that we would create a neural network for this game, which was one of a kind, got a lot of attention from the press. And we would make it something more than a predictable text adventure game where you can really feel the constraints of the branching. By using this neural network, it would learn from your actions and it would have a life of its own. And so through that, we wrote these huge scripts that would train the neural network system, and they were very nonlinear. The idea was that you would have these banks of things that the characters could say or do, and they would draw from that based on how the ecosystem was developing in the world that you were interacting with. And so it was a very ambitious game, very creative, and still a very modern game in so many ways. You could play a male or female character, but you could go in any way you wanted in terms of your sexual orientation. You could flirt with anybody and everybody. You could pursue happiness in any way, in a multiple of ways. You could leave and start your own company. You could rise to the top. You could retire with dignity. You could get married. You could do all kinds of things. So we didn't want to limit the player. And the idea would be that you could learn from yourself and have this true experiment where you might say, well, this is the way that I would go through this world. But what if I just did everything the opposite of how I would intuitively do it? What would happen that way? So we had infinite replayability with it. But unfortunately, we were getting close to being done. But at that time, Disney Software was going through some issues with money. It wasn't performing as well as Disney, as the corporation was hoping. And so they made huge cuts across the board. Anything in development was canceled, which was why all my adventure games got canceled. Right. And we went from having outside developers, they were going to do an in-house developer paradigm instead. And so I was just devastated, especially that Doggy Dog got canceled. And so we had a lot of CinemaWare people, you know, ex-CinemaWare people working on it. And through that connection, we were almost instantaneously able to sell the property to Trilobite, which was these ex-CinemaWare people. And they were very interested in it and looking to flesh out their new portfolio with something that was almost done and was innovative. And so we came in just to finish the game with Trilobite. But unfortunately, they soon realized, or at least they felt, that if it didn't have full motion video, which they were becoming famous for, then they couldn't publish it. And so they asked us to redesign the game for full motion video, which was kind of a catastrophe because our whole design was based on the idea that we could have these enormous free floating scripts. And we were sort of back to Dragon's Lair.
Right? Full circle.
If we had known that, we would have designed it completely differently. And so we all gamely worked to create a sort of, you know, so like a TV pilot kind of idea that it would be a series. And we shot this massive amount of Digi Beta Cam video. But it was unwieldy and really lost a lot of what was going to be the secret sauce of Dog Eat Dog. And Trilobite, they wound up just calling it a day with it because they had other things they wanted to do. And so Open Mind, the developer, and me, and we formed a group called Ministry of Thought, and we bought it back. So the Digi Beta Cam videos are sitting here in my house. I have the scripts. We have the code. And so someday we may be bringing it back on the internet. We're still considering that possibility.
That would be incredible. I was going to ask, actually, how much you still had of it. So there's pretty much everything you need there to make it into a full game still then, is there?
Yeah, there is.
Wow. Well, fingers crossed that happens one day. I know there's a lot of like indie software companies out there that I'm sure would love to put something like that out. So if any are listening and maybe they'll reach out to you, that'd be awesome. So outside of video games as well, obviously you're also an author as well. So tell us about your books because they sound really interesting. What are some of your titles that people should look out for?
Oh, thank you for asking. Yeah, so, you know, I continue writing on the side, and for anyone who's interested, my other claim to fame is that I am the curator of the Candy Wrapper Museum, a collection of candy wrappers that I started as a teenager back in those Pong days. And I've become sort of a subject matter expert when it comes to candy history and candy ephemera. So I have three books out on candy wrappers and candy history, one classic candy that's sort of an overview. And then I have two books about the history of Necco, making those Necco wafers. And in short, I had received all this Necco ephemera. Necco is now out of business, but a lot of their stuff was thrown in the dumpster. A future-oriented person saved it from all this great stuff from the dumpsters. And I took it, they sent it to the Candy Wrapper Museum. And my husband Joe and I, we cleaned it all up. We researched it. We created this incredible in-depth archive of the story of Necco, which is one of the great American industrial stories, and put it all together into not one, but two beautiful picture and history books. And so I have my candy books out there. And being an ephemera fan, just somebody who has always collected along the lines, I've also created a humor book called A Woman's Guide to Low Self-Esteem, which is about how women out there, anyone who's listening, if you hate your thighs, you hate your hair, you hate your nails, this is the expose that shows why you do, based on just a ton of advertising, negative advertising out there for centuries, convincing women that everything about them is wrong. So that's another one I have out there. And also for you video game nerds out there, an illustrated discography about the musical career of Leonard Nimoy as Spock and as Nimoy, a really fun book that's out there. So
I remember seeing Bilbo Baggins, which was one of the tunes that he did as well on YouTube. And I was like, I never knew Leonard Nimoy did music. But yeah, this is great.
Read all about it. It's really a great story.
Where do people get hold of your books?
You can buy them on Amazon primarily. So we also have a few of them up through Ingram Spark, but mostly they're up there on Amazon.
Great. Well, I'll find the Amazon links and I'll put them in the show notes so people can click through.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Well, Darlene, it's been incredible to talk to you, and what an amazing career you've had as well. So long may it continue. Best of luck with future books as well. And thank you for coming on and reminiscing about these incredible games that you worked on too. It's been absolutely fascinating to talk to you.
Thank you again for having me on the show. It's just been such a pleasure. It's fun to talk about these stories. I hope they inspire game designers out there today and future game designers.